Okay, now about our speaker. When I came into this room, I started to hear that name all over every meeting I went to, and I did not know who he was, but ladies and gentlemen keep mentioning his name. And I was wondering, wow, this person must be so special, so important, because so many people love him. And that stuck with me right away. I met him a few weeks later, of course, in one of the meetings. I introduced myself because I had to. I'm like, oh, you are that person I've been hearing about. We had a really good speaker coming in tonight. That person couldn't make it, so please help me to welcome Plan B, Rick.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
My name is Rick Evans. I will always be alcoholic. I would like to thank anybody who took a chip, especially the lady who took 25 years. That's pretty astonishing. I'd like to congratulate anybody who's new or relatively new. You're here and you're alive. That's a pretty big deal for people like us. I have a sobriety date. Nobody's sure entirely exactly when it is, but it's a Sunday, and I think it's in February, and it's definitely in 1991. We celebrate February 3rd. It could be February 10th, or it could be January, like 27th, but it's one of those days back then. It used to drive me crazy trying to figure that out, but at this point, I don't think it really matters anymore. I grew up in the Midwest in a small village in Ohio, about 5,000 people. It was very much like Mayberry. Nothing bad ever happened to me. I had a mostly fine childhood, no real issues of any kind. I never saw anybody drink. My parents didn't drink, and seldom drank. I think I saw them have a drink once on New Year's Eve. I just didn't know people who drank. For some reason, however, when I was 16, my parents went away, and I had gotten in with a group of guys who thought we should have a party, and to have a party, we needed to have alcohol, and we arranged to do that, and I drank for the first time, and that first drink I had, I can't actually tell, it was either what I called a screwdriver, or it was Wild Irish Rose, one of the two, or some combination thereof, and it was like heaven. I knew exactly this is how I wanted to feel. This is exactly what I was missing my whole life. I've never had a feeling like that, except for one other time, and I'll tell you about that one. It was when I was small. I can't remember when we were in second or third grade. We had people came around and tested us in school for our vision, part of the school system. And they told me that I needed glasses, and they ordered the glasses, and my parents ordered the glasses and stuff, and a couple weeks later, I don't even remember whether they came to school or had to go to an eye doctor or something, but they got the glasses out, and they put them on, and when they put them on, it was like, holy shit, that's what the world looks like. And I had never seen the world that way. I never saw it. All I ever knew was my blurry vision. And when the glasses came on, I knew that's how the world was supposed to look, just instinctively. And the only other time I felt that was on that first drink. That's not a good sign for people. It's not in my case anyhow. It was a challenge for me to drink. Like I said, it was a small village and everybody knew everybody. I was best friends with the police chief's son. We were in the same school class and we hung out together, and I was in Boy Scouts with the sheriff's kid, and I started having visits by the police way before I started drinking. It was mostly for stuff like throwing corn cobs at cars and stuff like that, typical farm crap. It was not long after I started drinking that the visits from the cops became different. And I never got arrested, at least initially. It was not unusual for to find the police chief or the sheriff in my parents' living room when I got home. And if they were both there at the same time, I knew I was in bigger trouble than usual. I started drinking when I was 16. I started doing those other issues when I was 17. I managed to get out of my my school stuff changed then. I dropped out of sports. My grades started to slip, but they were still pretty good. I take tests pretty well, and I got out of high school at 18, and I had an academic scholarship to Harvard. I'm only telling you that because I'm not a college graduate today, so just keep that in mind. At 19, I was a dropout from the school I chose to go to. At 20, I was in jail for the first time for smuggling other issues into the county jail back home. I'd been successful at it sometimes, but I was unsuccessful this time, and they caught me and they kept me. They didn't ever file charges on that one either. Where does that take me? 19 to 20. At 21, I was trying to kill myself for the first time. And 22, I was lying on a job application, trying to convince people that I had the skill to be a dishwasher. I succeeded and I got that job. And what I like to say from that point on, it takes me to, 21 or 22, something like that. I got sober when I was 33, and from 21 through 33, I just hated my life. I mean, it was just terrible stuff. There are people in this room, I'm not certain, but I think it's likely that you've been in jail more often than me, but I've been in jail a lot. I've never been there more than one night, but I was there a lot of one nights. I've been arrested for drunk driving in 3 states, came out of a blackout chained to an eye bolt in the floor of the Florence City Jail in South Carolina once, not knowing what I was there for. I've been arrested for drunk driving, drunk walking, drunk sleeping, drunk bicycling, drunk braking and entering, a wide variety of things. The only time I was never drunk when I got arrested was that first time when I was smuggling the other issues. There are people that have never been in jail. I know a number of you in this room. Not that many of you. There are people who have tried to kill themselves more often than I have, and there are people who have never tried to kill themselves. There are people who have been married more than me that have never been married, that are still married to the same person. None of this stuff really matters. What really matters is that if you're like me, when you take the first drink, everything's off the table. It's time to go wherever it's going to go. And bad stuff didn't happen to me that often. You know, I drank pretty much regularly every day for those 17 years, and that's a lot of days, you know. 365 times 17 is thousands of days, and there were only probably 250 or 500 bad ones, really bad ones. But, you know, normal people who have bad days like me don't continue drinking. I like to tell these stories about that. One time when we were kids, we were playing on my grandpa's farm, and we used to love to go up in the hayloft, me and the cousins, and swing out on the ropes and drop down into the pile of hay. And my one cousin thought this would be really funny. He gave me the rope on the pulley instead of the one on the fixed to the ceiling. And you don't get to swing out; you just drop, right? And I dropped straight down. I landed on the disc and cut the shit out of myself. You know. I'm all, you know, you're, 8, 9, 10 years old or something. You got to deal with all the parents and aunts and uncles and stuff. But I lived through it. I don't even hardly have any scars from it anymore. But the point is that after that day, I never, ever went up in the hayloft and swung out on a rope again. One time, that's all it took. Other thing is, when I was supposedly going to school at Ohio State, we used to roller skate in the summertime on Ohio State. It's a very large school. There's 55 some thousand undergrads. There's 10 or 15,000 graduate students. There's another 15, 20,000 employees. And in the summer when I was there, it went down to 5 or 10,000 people on campus, so it's like a ghost town. The place is just empty. And we loved to roller skate in the parking garages because they were empty, and you could haul ass right down those ramps, you know. And I was always drunk or the other stuff from doing it, and one time I was drunk enough, I didn't count the ramps, and I went down all the ramps, and I went around the last one, and not slowing down, still going full speed, and there's nothing but a block wall. And I hit it full speed on roller skates, however fast that is. It's not that fast, but it was plenty fast, I'm telling you. And it hurt. and once again, a normal person would say, I'm never going to drink again. I quit roller skating. And I think most of us in somewhat different circumstances would share those kind of experiences. My experience is that you get arrested 25 or 50 times for alcohol, you get sentenced to AA, and that was my experience. I was sentenced to hundreds of AA meetings. Before I ever started getting sentenced to them, letting you all in on this, if you're on a court card, nobody cares. You can sign your own. I was signing other people's court cards for them way before I had my own. And then I started getting my own, and it never once occurred to me not to go to the AA meetings. I was drunk at all of them, and then I sat through and didn't pay any attention, and I got more drunk afterward, but I went to all of them. And I remember next to nothing about it, except one guy, and I'll maybe talk about him or maybe not, I'm not sure. A couple more drunk log things. I used to be a big Jimmy Buffett fan, and we used to go to a lot of shows back in the 70s and 80s with him. That was before the whole parrothead thing really got going, but they were pretty rowdy shows, and his fans are noted for their celebrations. I stopped going to see Jimmy Buffett when I went the last time in like 1987. I was too drunk and they wouldn't let me in. And my friends were disgusted with me as usual, and they wouldn't take me back to the car. They just said, screw you, Evans, or something like that, and I had to wander around just wasted in this parking lot. And it's those kind of things. It's not the fact that I got turned down. It's the way I felt after I got turned down. Here I am again. How does this happen? My experience was I wasn't really so angry about it. I was just always sick and confused. How could this be happening? Growing up in the Midwest, in Ohio, you have tornadoes. I seldom ever saw one, but I was familiar with tornado warnings and the sirens and stuff. And another thing is, I don't know if you ever grew up back there or been around them, but when it's tornado weather, the sky turns this weird green color. I've never seen anything like it. But if you see the sky turn green, get the hell down in a ditch and stay there until you're sure there's no cloud around. And I'm driving from Columbus up to Mansfield, where I grew up one time, and I saw the sky turn green, and I thought, this isn't good, and I looked off in the distance. I saw a funnel cloud that looked like it was coming my direction, and I pulled over, and I got down in the ditch, and I just hoped that it wasn't coming near me, and it didn't. It passed by. It wasn't even that close to me. But what did happen is I got back in the car, and I continued driving. Another 5 minutes or less than that, 5 or 10 minutes, and I got into the next little town that was on the road, and the tornado had hit that town. And I got there 5 or 10 minutes right after the tornado bed, and people were just now coming out of their houses. And there were cars upside down, there were roofs off, and there were trees down, and people are holding each other and hugging each other and crying and just this look of despair and terror. And I recognized the look, because that's how he used to look at me. The people I loved the most would look at me that way after I did one of my behaviors. And those looks would make me feel just miserable, terrible, like, how can this keep happening? Having said that, I never tried to stop drinking, but I just wanted the bad stuff to go away, right? But I never really did stop drinking. I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous in early 1991. My brother had come to visit me in California, down in L.A., and while he was here, and I'm working at this club down in Palos Verdes, and he's staying with me, so I can't drink the way I want to for Christmas, right? I'm trying to keep my job in line, and he's there, and I have to pretend like everything's okay. So I'm white knuckling things all the way through him being here, and then he leaves, and I keep it together for a few more days, and then I'm going to start drinking, right? And this turned into the one, right? And I, uh, I, and I was too drunk. I was so drunk. I was not going to work. And I called my boss and told him that I was in jail because I thought that sounded more fitting than telling him I was too drunk to get out of bed, right? And I love vodka. That was what I drank then. Plastic half gallons of Lucky Vodka from the supermarket. It was the cheapest stuff out there, and I kept breaking the glass ones, and this was the way out for me. I got enough money together to load my, I had this Samsonite suitcase like this tall, this long. I got from getting out of high school or something, and I loaded up with half gallons of vodka and headed over to the Marriott. This time I was going to succeed. I was going to drink enough to be dead. And I drank those 8 or 10 half gallons in a couple days, and I'm unconscious as usual, and I regained consciousness, and I was still alive. And I just could not believe it. I mean, how can I still be here? How can this be happening? And I'll tell you the suicide story too. I stopped trying to kill myself as a result of a marriage I was in. Here's that part of the drunk walk too. I got married to a woman I wasn't in love with, and I didn't even like her very well, but she was a pharmacist. So I figured at that point in my life, this is going to be my solution. But the problem is, at that point in my drinking, that anybody who would put up with me was probably a lot like me, and I ended up marrying somebody very much like me, and that relationship sucked. And I tried to kill myself through that relationship and failed again and lived. And about that time, I was selling other issues to quadriplegics and paraplegics. I had a friend back in Columbus who worked at a residence facility for him, and he was an attendant or something like that, and a number of these gentlemen, they were all men, had big insurance settlements from accidents they'd been in, and they had a lot of money and a lot of time on their hands, and I was willing to help them with that. And I don't remember anything about what they looked like. I don't remember their names or anything, but I do remember one guy, and I don't remember his name either, but he was completely paralyzed. He was he controlled his chair by blowing in a tube, and I would fix this stuff up for him and let him get it into his system, and until this other issue wore off, he would blow in the tube and spin in circles like that. And that was my single moment of clarity, and I'm thinking, you know what, next time I try to kill myself, this is a possible outcome. I can end up in a chair like this. I can want to change my mind, but if I do it to myself, there's not going to be any insurance settlement. I'm just going to be tied to a chair, stuck in my head. So I stopped trying to kill myself, but this is like 1986 or something. I don't get to get sober for 5 more years. So from that point on, I just get to get drunk and wish I'm dead every day. It's not a real fun way to get through life in my experience. So anyhow, I failed at this last suicide attempt down in L.A., and I go back home and I try and just drink and keep the desperate knowledge of my condition to myself and think there's got to be a way out maybe or something, and if there's not, I'm drinking around the clock. I'm unconscious for 2 hours. I'm awake for 30 minutes. I throw up on crap on myself and then get some drink down and throw up again, and then I drink some more and I pass out again for 2 hours and repeat until it's over. And I got to this point where I was reaching down for the vodka and it was empty. And I had enough togetherness to think, man, I got to get some vodka together. So I stumbled out of bed and I found enough booze of some kind to get me fixed and start tapering off until I can go outside and get money somehow. And as part of that process, I turned the ringer on my phone on, and I turned the answering machine back on, and my memory is that the phone rang immediately, right as soon as I turned it on. And I'm foggy, I'm telling you, so it could have been 2 weeks later, but I'm telling you, I think I turned the phone on and it rang. And I answered the phone. I talked to another person for the first time in those 3 weeks or whatever it was, and he identified himself, and as soon as he said his name, my heart sank because I knew he was sober. and I had no intention of talking to the sober person. And he said, "Hi, Richard, this is Sid so-and-so, how you doing?" And I lied to him, and I said, "I'm doing fine, thanks for calling, Sid, how are you?" He said, "He's fine." He said, "Well, what have you been up to?" And I lied to him again, I said, "Not much, I've just been going to some meetings." And I he laughed because he knew I wasn't going to meetings. I hadn't been to meetings for years, and he would have seen me, and I hated him for laughing. But I was just desperate. He asked me one more question. He said, "Why don't you tell me where you live? I'll come over tonight. We'll go to a meeting together." And I told him where I really live. And I, you understand. That's like Saturday morning or afternoon or something. I spent the next 4 hours, 5 hours, whatever it was, drinking exactly the correct amount of Lucky Vodka so nobody would know that I hadn't had food for 3 weeks. And I would take my first shower and find some Old Spice and pour it over me and stuff. And you know, we camouflage it right, so I'm sure everybody understood that. And we went to the big speaker meeting down in San Pedro on Saturday night. And Sid is sober for 5 years or something, and he's taking me in, and he's shaking every single person out of these 200 people's hands and introducing me to them. And I'm just like, I'm already shaken, and I just can't stand the way I feel. But I'm trapped. I'm just trapped. I don't know what to do. So I go in, we sit down, and for the first time in all those hundreds of AA meetings, they ask for newcomers, and I stood up and I said, "My name is Rick, and I'm an alcoholic." And I sat through the meeting. Jerry Rush was the speaker. Jerry R. was the speaker that night. I remember two things, that he was the CEO of Black & Decker, and that once he started drinking, he and his family were homeless and living on leftover donuts at the Alano Club. And I heard that, and I thought, well, that's valuable information. That's something I might need to know. And we got through the meeting, and afterward we're standing up and leaving, and Sid is shaking the same 150 people's hands saying, "Are you going out for coffee? Are you going out for dinner? Are you going out?" And that's my first day of prayer, is please God, don't make me go out with these people tonight. And somehow nobody was going out, or I managed to get him to take me home, and I went home, and for the first time in all those meetings, I didn't drink that night. And he picked me up the next morning, and I went to my first sober meeting of alcoholics at the Torrance Lomita Club in Torrance. And I raised my hand as a newcomer again, and that was my first sober meeting, as I said. At the end of that meeting, a gentleman gave me my first sober big book. I'd had several of them before for various reasons. I still have that big book. It's not this one, but I still have it. By the grace of a higher power revealed to me through the action of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, as shown to me by Sid C. Back in those 23 years ago, I've come to know a higher power through the spiritual experience with educational variety, and I have not had to have a drink. And I don't know why. I still don't know why, and it doesn't even matter to me anymore. But I do know what I did. I know clearly, except for the blackouts, what I did before then, and I know clearly, very clearly, what I've done since then. And what I've done is go to meetings. I've had five different sponsors now. I had Sid in L.A., then I moved to Orange County, and I met a guy. I didn't get a sponsor because I'm 7 years sober, right? And I got this thing wired. I'm sitting in my home group, the Thursday night Anderson Men's Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Newport Beach, and this big-ass guy from Texas walks in. He's been around for 15 or 20 years, and he starts sharing me. And one of the things he says in that first meeting I was at was, "Show me an example. Show me somebody who sponsors himself, and I'll show you an example of what unskilled labor can produce." And I went up and asked him to sponsor me after that meeting, and he was my sponsor throughout my time in Orange County. I moved to Riverside, and I got a gentleman named C.J. Littlepage. He's passed away now. He was a great guy, wonderful sponsor. And as soon as he passed away, I got another sponsor named Wiley R. He's still alive. He and his wife were part of our couples group down in Riverside. I moved up here. I didn't waste any time. I got a real knucklehead for a sponsor down here. A lot of you know him, and I won't give give you his name because he doesn't deserve that, but he was designated a sociopath by the California Department of Corrections, so you might be able to guess who it is. Yeah, and I've also sponsored people. What it was like and what's different, I'll tell you about that first wedding, the pharmacist, the one I didn't even like, right? We got married in the VFW hall. You ever seen The Deer Hunter, the movie? Do you remember the wedding? That's the wedding. The one at the VFW hall with me and the guys all drinking shots with the vets in the back hall while the party's going on, and my wife's cousin was one of our grooms. He passed out during the ceremony. The night before, we were partying with one of the big-name rock bands from the 70s at this hotel down in Dayton. They left at 4 in the morning, told us we were crazy, and we kept going. At the reception, there were guns, and there was fights, and there was just insanity. One of my pals was in the wedding and went to the hospital after the reception so he could get his stomach pumped. That's the kind of wedding I was in. I met Carol in 1993, something like that, down in Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles. She's never seen me drink, and I've never seen her drink. We got together, we dated, we made friends, we became boyfriend and girlfriend, we became committed, and we got married in the basement of a Lutheran church. There was no alcohol. The food was done by some employees of mine because I was a cheap bastard. A friend of ours did the flowers. Another friend of ours took the photographs. Sober friends. The sober friend took videotape, I think, something like that. It was like there was no fighting. It was a beautiful spiritual wedding. We're still married today. We've been part of couples groups beginning in Orange County. We started one in Riverside. We're in one here in Visalia now. When I was new, or relatively new, we had a friend in a book study we used to go to down in Palos Verdes, and he was sharing one night, and he said that he was a selfish, dishonest son of a bitch, and I'd rather be alone anyhow. And when he said it, I was like, holy crap, he knows me. And that is the way I was. And the problem with me is, that selfish, dishonest, rather be alone stuff, it did not start when I started drinking. It started beforehand. I was a criminal out of the gate. I wasn't a very good criminal. I wasn't a very big criminal, but I was a criminal. I would rather lie than tell the truth. If you give me $100 for telling the truth and a day in jail for lying, I'll still lie. I am. And those things continued. And today I'm still a selfish, dishonest son of a bitch. I'd rather be alone anyhow. But the only people who know that about me now are you people, the ones I tell it to, because my behavior doesn't show that any longer. Now, some other things back there, I used to be a sleazy, low-life, petty criminal. That I am not anymore. I did not break the law. I'll tell you my day-to-day. I got up about 5 or 5:30. I took care of the dog and the cats. I goofed around at home for a while. I went down to the Vintage Press to meet a colleague of mine and the director of development for the Visalia Rescue Mission, because some people that I'm associated with are putting on a fundraiser for them on Sunday. And we were there because we were doing a remote TV broadcast for one of those morning shows up in Fresno. I can't remember which one. While I was there, a reporter from the paper came in and wanted to talk to me about some issues that are going on in the restaurant industry, so I interviewed with them and went on. Then I went to work after that, and I did some more stuff relating to my paid job and to this fundraiser. I left there, and I went to the downtown Rotary Club, of which I'm a member, and sat through that at noon. After that, I went home and took a freaking nap for half an hour, and then I went back to work. And at 5:30 tonight, we had an event for that fundraiser, at which amateur celebrity cooking contest, which raises money for the mission. people who were there. Some of the contestants were the sheriff and the mayor and some other fairly well-known local people. And they all know me in a different way than the people back home used to know me. They've never seen me talk. And a lot of them know that I'm sober. I've spoken at most of the Rotary clubs here in Visalia about being an alcoholic and being part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they still allow me to participate. And I've told them the truth, too. And I left there and I came here. Tell you I'm wearing a jacket and a tie because that's what I do at work usually. I'm also doing it because even if it wasn't for work, this is what I was taught to do when I get the opportunity to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. This program has saved my life. It's given me a life that I didn't know was possible. And to just show my gratitude and respect for this program, that's why I'm dressed this way. The one guy I remember from Alcoholics Anonymous before I got sober, I remember him. I remember his name. It was Singin' Sam. I never understood why they called him Singin' Sam, because he was a little sawed-up longshoreman down in San Pedro. And what I remember of him was we used to have a lot of these guys back then. They spent most of their time sharing and going like this with the big book and saying, "Get sober or die, motherfucker. Get out. If you don't want to be here, go drink." And that passed for their version of kindness and compassion a lot of times. And there was more than one of them, but he was one of them. And the reason I remember him, because when I was in those meetings with him, I knew he was talking to me, because one of the things he was always shouting was, "Can you hang tough for just one day? Can you stay sober till midnight? Can you make it, young man?" He didn't even know I was in the room, I don't think. But I knew that I was going to leave the meeting and get drunk, more drunk. And that got in my head, and by the time I got sober, he had died. And what I found out is that they called him Singing Sam because he quoted song lyrics. I must have gone to a dozen meetings with him. I never heard a song lyric. All I heard him was thumping the book and screaming and threatening the newcomers. And it's interesting because I love music and I relate to music in a lot of ways, and I relate to some of these songs, and I think I'm going to quote a few of them while I'm here tonight. But one of the things I'm going to talk about is inventory and the steps. Do not cheat yourself. Do the freaking steps. They're not that hard. What's hard is not doing the steps and trying to stick around here. I used to play basketball with some guys down in Compton in LA when I first got sober, before I was fat, and I was almost always the only white guy, Johnny was one of them, and I hung out with these guys at the Compton Alano Club and the men's stag down there, I think on Monday nights. And Johnny would always talk about the steps, and I ran into him again. He had moved to Riverside when I got there, so I reconnected with him. He said there's only four steps. We give up, we face up, we make up, and we keep up. It's not that difficult, folks. Number one, we got to stop, and then we can start changing our lives. I didn't do the steps fast. I did the first three steps in 90 days. I said, "Check this shit out. I'm going to be done in a year." Year and a half later, I still haven't done a fourth step or a fifth step. And this is one of the days that my life changed. I got a job at the managing the Elks Club down in San Pedro. And there was this 6'4", 160-pound, goofy-looking motherfucker who had got, he was just skinny. He looked like Big Bird. And he talked like this. He said, "My name is Anthony. Do you want to be my friend?" And he would not leave me alone. He's like that Seinfeld thing where the guy's just there all the time, no matter what. And so he's just part of it so much. So eventually I had to talk to him. And it turns out that when he found out that I was an alcoholic, that he decided he was an alcoholic too. I'm still not sure he ever even had a drinking problem, but he might have. But as a result of that, he asked me to sponsor him, and because of that, I went to my sponsor and said, I need to finish the steps. And I finished the steps to stay ahead of Anthony. And he changed my life. I cannot tell you what a difference that's made for me. He didn't get to stay sober. He didn't get to live. He looked the way he did because he got cancer when he was 5 years old and still had it when I knew him at 55. And he died a few years later. That same time frame, I'm young and I'm going to meetings with a woman from the National Council on Alcoholism down in Torrance. She's given me newcomers that are like me. Young white guys that can't keep jobs, women, and do a lot of drugs and go to jail. We're having a great time staying sober, right? And we're working this shit out of something. I don't know if it was the steps or not, but I'm having things are right. And this other guy asked me to sponsor him, and he wasn't one of these guys. He was ready to retire from the same job he'd had for 40 years. He was still married to the same woman he'd had all his kids with. He hadn't been fired. He hadn't never done drugs. He hadn't ever been to jail. I figured this isn't right. I got nothing for this guy. He's nothing like me. And I prayed about it. I thought about it. I talked to my sponsor. I talked to some other old timers, and they suggested I give it a shot. And I gave it a shot. I have 23 years in the week, approximately a week after I celebrated my sobriety last year. He celebrated 22 years sober. His name is Howard. I'm still in touch with him. I don't know the name of any of those other guys that we were changing the world with. The message I get out of that is that you need to sponsor the people who ask you to sponsor them. And that's what I try and do. I only know how to do it one way, and to tell you the truth, I'm perfectly fine if you don't do it. But the answer is that I need to try and be out there and be of service. Here's some top secret information for you. I was a weird kid. It's a good thing you're all sitting down, right? 7th, 8th grade, I'm 6th, 7th, 8th grade, I'm reading philosophy, right? I'm a smart little shit, too. And I have already this need to know, to figure out why. And I'm reading all kinds of stuff. I'm not sure I understood too much of it, but I do remember the transcendentalists who were Thoreau and Whitman and Emerson and those guys from the 19th century here in the United States. And one of the key things that they thought was that the ultimate purpose of mankind is to be of service to other people. And when I read that, I knew that these guys were on to something. Then at 16, I drank, and I went, screw this stuff, and I'm out for myself, right? And then I'm going to AA meetings and stuff, and I finally get here sober, and I start listening, and they start saying, you got to be of service. I'm like, son of a bitch. I could have just skipped this stuff. You know? But I didn't. I went through it all, and that lesson is burned into my brain. I need to be of service in whatever way I can. I'm lucky. I work in an industry that's considered a service industry, so I get to be of service to a bunch of people, a lot of whom I don't even give a shit about or don't like, but I still get to try and be kind to them. My life is full of AA. The inventory thing. I did the resentment column. I'm thinking this is great. 5 resentments, myself, God, my dad, that's about it. You know, nothing there. This is going to be a snap. Then he says, and you know, I've been going to book studies this whole time, right? Then he says, okay, now you're going to write about your fears. And I thought, fears? Where the hell is that shit? And I don't have fears. I fight with cops. I jump out of airplanes. I hang off the side of mountains. There's no fear with me. I wrote down 3 or 4 pages of fear before I was done, and that was a revelation to me. It was just a revelation. My behavior was fear-based. I still am afraid of all kinds of stuff. I have got to narrow down 2 things I'm really only afraid of now. I'm afraid of being alone. I'm afraid of being with people. That's just the way I got to live, you know? And it's because of things like that that I drank, because drinking took that insanity away from me. It created a whole different level of insanity, but it was that. I wasn't really too violent too often. I was more a flight kind of guy. I'd much rather run, but there is some fighting. I used to live with a guy who was an All-American college linebacker. He was on the box of Wheaties in high school, and he was an All-Pro NFL linebacker, and I didn't like him. So I didn't want him to live with us, so I picked fights with him every day for 6 months until he got tired of beating my ass and he moved out. I heard something about the definition of insanity, right? My reaction to fear is different today. But here's one of the songs I want to share with you. It's by Merle Haggard. It's called The Running Kind. I think he might be one of us because this is my brain. It says, I was born the running kind, with leaving always on my mind. Home was never home to me at any time. Every front door found me open. I would find the back door open. There just had to be an exit for the running kind. Within me, there's a prison surrounding me alone, as real as any dungeon with walls of stone. I know running's not the answer, but running's been my nature, and a part of me that keeps me moving on. That was my life. That's how I got here. I was going to go to jail for more than one night in Ohio back then. And the other thing, there was you guys remember that band Kansas from back in the 70s? Anybody remember a song called 2 Cents Worth? It wasn't popular, but it was. I heard it and I knew this was the answer to life. Well, I've been drinking again and I know it's a sin, but I just can't refuse an old friend. Because life is getting me down, I've been 2 times around, and there ain't nothing but pain around the bend. I'm not made for the time, I'm born in the wrong century, there's too much craziness here. 25 years I've used all the tears in my eyes. Now this old world is a fright, you know my future ain't bright, and I'd just crawl in a hole if I could, or maybe live out in space or some other faraway place and not come back to this earth till it's good. Oh, but I'm dreaming again, I know that I'm here to land, there's too much craziness here, in 25 years I've used all the tears in my eyes. What kind of 18-year-old thinks that's the answer to life? This kind. That's the lyrics that made sense to me. I'm going to give you one other song before I wrap up here, and it's by a guy named Jimmy Dale Gilmore. It's called These Blues. When I get these blues, I just look back down that road. It's been a while since I laid down that load. These blues ain't nothing like the blues I had before I paid a little debt I owed. When I get these blues, I just look back down that road. Everything I ever needed was on the shelf. Spent all of my time feeling sorry for myself. I was drifting and dreaming and waiting and watching for a ship with a silver sail. But I got lucky. I woke up in jail. There's none so blind as he who will not see. It's easy to see that I could not see that was me. When he washed ashore, the drunken sailor was adrift in the city night, and you'd better believe, in the morning my burden was light. Well, I don't know where I'm going, but I know where I've been. There ain't no need to ever go back again. And my very worst days are so much better than the very best I knew back then. And I thank the Lord that a loser can sometimes win. Yeah, I thank the Lord a loser can sometimes win. That's one more thing and I'll wrap up. My father and I didn't get along for a lot of years. No father would get along with me if I was your son. I was a dick. And it was a contentious relationship. As a result of getting sober and being with Carol, I was able to tell my father for the first time that I loved him on Father's Day, maybe in 1994 or something like that. And I continued telling him that for years. And he never told me he loved me. On Carol's 15th anniversary, we were having a party for her down in Riverside, and he and my mom had come out to California to visit. And during that party, he gave me this envelope. It says, Rick, I found this in looking through some things. I thought you might like it, Dad. It says, Mansfield, Ohio, AA, Ed Evans, June 4th, 1948. That's my grandfather. Later on, we did a We did a thing for my parents' 50th anniversary, in which I was one of the main speakers, and I thoroughly explained to everybody in a lighthearted and not serious way what a pain in the ass my dad was, and talked about how things had changed between us as a result of my behavior, and how that even though I told him I loved him, and he didn't tell me he loved me, I continued to do that. And he wrote me a note after that party thanking me for doing it and said, just because something isn't expressed doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Last year, a year and a half ago, I told him I loved him. He told me he loved me. Clap for yourselves if you're clapping, because it wasn't me. People just like you. This is really the end of it. When I was down in L.A., there's a guy named Milt Bell who used to give step studies, and his dumb guy approach. He was a Polack from Cleveland, and we became friends because I was in these sessions with him, and we bonded because we've been in different jails in the same city back in 1977. Such thing are treasures made, right? So this is the way Milk ends meetings when he gets to lead one. I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous being in it is a privilege. It's an honor to get asked to lead a meeting or to speak at a meeting like this. I want you all to know that my higher power reveals himself to me through other people, and I want you all to know that you are like big, beautiful stained glass windows. I can see the light of God shining through each one of you. Thank you for my sobriety.
Thank you. Thank you, Rick, very much. Thank you for being here, and thank you for supporting so many people.